So, welcome everyone. It's good to see so many people out. Tonight I'm going to be talking about investigation. So the topic of investigation, seeing for yourself what is true. This comes up from last week's dialogue that we had regarding how mindfulness and investigation fit together, and how the mind gets involved in this understanding of the Dharma and understanding who we truly are and how things operate in our lives, how our experience manifests, and so on. And it's a sticky topic because we have these minds that like to figure things out logically and rationally. And this is a little bit different, although there is a role for logic and rationality as well, but we really don't need a lot of coaching on that on that aspect. So I'm going to start with a Rumi poem, which kind of, for me, sums up the difference between rational thinking and the kind of knowledge and understanding that I'll be talking about tonight. And it's called Two Kinds of Intelligence by Rumi. There are two kinds of intelligence. One acquired as a child in school, memorizes facts and concepts from books and from what the teacher says, collecting information from the traditional sciences as well as from the new sciences. With such intelligence, you rise in the world. You get ranked ahead of or behind of others in regard to your competence in retaining information. You stroll with this intelligence in and out of fields of knowledge, getting always more marks on your preserving tablets. There is another kind of tablet, one already completed and preserved inside you, a spring overflowing its spring box, a freshness in the center of your chest. This other intelligence does not turn yellow or stagnant. It's fluid, and it doesn't move from outside to inside through the conduits of plumbing learning. The second knowing is a fountainhead from within you moving out. So it's this second kind of intelligence that I'll be talking about. This it doesn't move from the outside in, but is a fountainhead within you moving out. And the Buddha spoke often about investigation. It's the second of the seven factors of awakening. It's embedded throughout the Four Noble Truths and in so many other places. And the word, the Pali word is Dhammavikaya, and that gets translated in different ways. It's can mean discrimination of states, investigation of truths, discernment. Now, these kinds of words are used: searching, investigating, scrutinizing one's personal experience, personal conditions. Joseph Goldstein frames it as that which discerns and illustrates the truth by means of discriminating wisdom. And that's from his book, Mindfulness. A big, thick new book he has out called, entitled Mindfulness. So it's a, and we talked about this before, this idea of it being a non-intellectual, non-cognitive, intuitive, perhaps, is another word we could use, realization. Which arises with the aid of mindfulness. And this is, you know, I think the question last week was, well, what's an insight? Is it a thought? And I said, no, it's not a thought. Not in the strict way that we think of a thought. So it's non-cognitive. And so, of course, as soon as you hear that, you try and wrap your mind around it. Right? You try to think, well, what is this? And it's I was going to say grokkable, but now I've taken a word not a word and made it into something else. But it's graspable, you know, with the mind at a certain level, but not at at the deeper levels. So mindfulness is the first factor of awakening. And it's the foundation of investigation. We spend so much time talking about mindfulness. In fact, it's in society right now, it's many people know the word and have some idea at some level of what it is. And in itself, it's quite a powerful practice. Just being aware of what we're doing moment by moment, paying close attention to what we're doing moment by moment, has a tremendous transformative power in and of itself. And then especially if you add non-judgmentally to that, because now you're bringing in a allowing a component to it, which allows a clear seeing. So you're kind of, in a way, as soon as you say non-judgmentally, you're asking the mind to go, you know, not to be involved. It's an interesting way of saying non-cognitively. all the attitudes we bring to mindfulness are really about it being a non-cognitive activity, beginner's mind, seeing with the freshness of every experience is fresh and new, like a child would discover, you know, seeing a flower for the first time, or acceptance. Just allowing things to arise in our experience without trying to make them other than they are. They're all pointing towards this idea of getting kind of the cognitive thinking mind to kind of step aside and just let things, just let you see things for what they are. And the second factor, as I said, of awakening is investigation. And it's, they work together. Really, you need one. Can't work without the other. And this is a core part of the path. These two words, sati and dhammavikaya, mindfulness and investigation, as the translations are, as imperfect as those translations are. It's a core part of the path. It's what awakens us from ignorance. Krishnamurti has an interesting quote. He says, "It's the truth that liberates, not your efforts to be free." So it's not our efforts or our desire and efforts to be free. It's the truth itself. And that arises, is cultivated and develops through investigation. There's another poem. It's called, entitled "The Real Work" by Wendell Berry. "It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impended stream is the one that sings." Again, that's speaking to the mind letting go. When we no longer know what to do, we no longer know which way to go. That's when the real work begins. So we can turn the mind towards this kind of investigation, this discernment, figuring out what is skillful in our direct experience moment to moment, discriminating between wholesome and unwholesome states, as the Buddha talks about them, as unwholesome and wholesome. Really turning our attention to that. I used to watch Sherlock Holmes on television. And it's a really interesting way that he's paying attention to everything. These little minute details in his immediate environment. And you as the observer of this are trying to pay attention like he is, but you never do pay attention quite enough. I remember one time Watson said, you know, I asked him a question about if his observation powers are developing, and he said, well, how many stairs did we just walk up? Watson said, I don't know. There were 19. I'm just kind of like, wow, that's really paying attention to the detail. But if you watch that show, you can try. There's all these little things that, if you really pay attention and notice, they're there for you to see. But of course, only Sherlock sees them. So it's really observing it. You know, when we're practicing at that level of, I'm not saying, you know, go through your day, you know, noticing all the steps and every, I mean, you know, knowing what is on all the walls over there and over there, all the smile and the, you know, all these things that, you know, you notice. But I'm not saying you go through your whole day that way, but bring that noticing, observing to your practice. Nothing's too small to observe. You know, curious attention to what's arising moment by moment. Honest, curious attention. Unclouded, curious attention. It just points, just notices, just points to what's arising. So we, with this noticing, we begin to see, you know, what happens if we relate to things in this way. What happens if we relate to things in this way? What happens when we grasp or try to push away? Just noticing. What's happening in the body as that occurs? I buy this decaf coffee by they always put them in these little bags, and he likes to put them in the little bags because it fits under the machine. It's not ground, but it just pours out. So I like to pour them in a big bag. One that has a hole that lets the air out, because beans, they actually they let off air. If you put them in shrink wrap, it expands like a balloon. Anyway, I make a long story short, I pour these little beans bags into this big bag, and I was pouring it, and for some reason I made a little jerk, and the whole bag of beans fell on the floor. And immediately, Rocky, our dog, starts eating them, thinking it's a new kind of dog food or something. I'm not sure, but I just watched, you know, that contraction. Like, I didn't, profanities didn't fly or anything like that. But it was just this contraction in the chest, just noticing what happened in the body, And it's just a moment to just pause and say, okay, it's a bag of beans. it's not that big a deal. I can make it a meditation, picking them up and putting them back into the bag. So it's just noticing those details of our experience, and often coming to the body as kind of an anchor to that noticing, especially if it's an emotional arising. So we're looking at our direct experience with this open, honest, curiosity. It's at our direct experience. So what's that rising in that moment? So you know, after dropping the beans, a thought had arisen, oh, you're so blank, 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 blank. Well, that would be my experience in the moment to then pay attention to. Oh, it's a thought that arose. Oh, look how that makes me feel. Ah, just that investigation. So it's not like, oh, I'm a meditator, I shouldn't have those thoughts. Well, maybe that does arise. Well, then notice that. Ah, look, it's interesting how that makes me feel. And just going back to that and investigation. So it's really a experiential learning, I'm not bringing any rational thought to it. I'm just noticing what arises. I'm not trying to analyze, I wonder why that thought arose, and maybe that's due to my mother saying, or maybe it's due to, such and such. So it's the immediate present tense level of mind-body experience that we're investigating. That immediate present tense in the moment. Not what happened before or what might happen, but in that very moment, mind-body, which includes the heart, experience. So we're turning towards the inner workings of the mind-body. So the core of insight meditation, as we've said, is designed to enable us to penetrate our illusions about the nature of reality, which are perpetuated by our an inaccurate perception of the world and ourselves. And for us to do that requires a level of scrutinizing and deep looking into whatever arises. So whatever arises, even the dark night of the soul or the emotion that we just want to push down. In fact, the ones that we are tempted to avoid are the ones that have the most to teach us. So it's investigating everything, deeply looking at everything. And of course, with compassion. So we don't want to... So we may approach some of these things, these deeper things, dark night of the soul, intense emotions and so forth. We may just approach them and then ease off and approach and ease off. So there's bring some self-compassion to it. It's not meant to be a grueling experience. There can be a lot of joy and happiness as part of that process. And we're not trying to arrive at any intellectual conclusion. We don't need to, I paid attention to the beans, to the arisal, what arose in the body as the beans went all over the floor and Rocky started eating them. So what did I learn from that? And then bring rational thought to it. Which is what the mind may want to do. How about you, then you just notice that. So we're not trying to come to any intellectual conclusion. A quote from Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest master. Whatever we do, we should see ourselves. Reading books doesn't ever give rise to anything. The days pass by, but we don't see ourselves. Knowing about practice is practicing in order to know. It's a pretty meaty little quote there. Whatever we do, we should see ourselves. Reading books doesn't ever give rise to anything. The days pass by, but we don't see ourselves. Knowing about practice is practicing in order to know. So that's like wanting to seeing for yourself what is true. Not adopting the opinions of others or belief system. not even believing that you need to investigate. Not even believing that. I mean, seeing for yourself if this is helpful in your life. This quality of discernment and investigation. See that, even that for yourself, you know. If it's not, then, you know, ask a meditation teacher a couple questions about it. You know, I did it, and you know what? Made me feel, you know, didn't do anything for it, you know, and maybe find out question. So this discernment, one metaphor I should say that some people do, it's like you're in a dark room, and then the lights go on. That's the kind of the seeing that arises. You begin to see clearly without thinking about it. Just seeing clearly. So it's not thinking about. So, you know, we're looking deeply. There's other words that we hear, like reflection and contemplation. Those might be words that you've come across in your spiritual journey. The words I came across in mine. In the Christian tradition, you'll hear the word contemplation a lot. So these are other words that I'd like to address. Simply put, reflection is just putting a mirror to your immediate experience. It's like, you know, the light coming on, or, you know, just it does. The reflection doesn't. A mirror doesn't say anything back. It just reflects what is there. So that's kind of what I mean by reflection, and that's the what I've been talking about. So it's really no different than investigation. Contemplation is something else. It's bringing something to mind and resting with it. That's a description of one. I'll give you an example of it. So the Lectio Divina. People are familiar with that Benedictine approach to contemplation. It's an approach I was involved with for many years, bringing this Lectio Divina approach to investigation. So here are the steps of it. So you can see how this is a little different than the investigation that the Buddha was talking about, but also a very valuable way of being with ideas. So the first step is to calm the mind so that you can listen deeply or hear with the ears, the ear of our hearts, as Saint Benedict put it. This was Saint Benedict, was the one who came up with this approach. So allowing the mind to calm, so, you know, following the breath is a concentration practice, allows the mind to calm somewhat. It doesn't have to be like still, but just some kind of access concentration, as we've talked about before, the momentary concentration, so that you can hear with the ear of your hearts. The second is to choose some meaningful phrase, quote, or passage to work with. So here you're working with a text of some kind. I did this within the Christian tradition. I also did it with Gregory Kramer, except we called it contemplation, but we're essentially doing the same thing, but we were using Buddha suttas. And we would get on Skype with it was a while ago, so, you know, all had headsets and blurry pictures, and we would the text would go out before, and you'd read it but not contemplate it, And then we would, again, read it. We'd read it out loud. Each of us would read it out loud. So it would get read several times to the point where it's almost in memory. And then we would sit in meditation and contemplate this text over Skype still. So we'd just sit in silence. You'd hear people breathing and in Switzerland and all over the place, Oregon. And then we would have a dialogue about, you know, what came up in that process. It was a wonderful wonderful group and very illuminating practice. So that brings me to the third step. It's to take the passage into your heart and ruminate on it. You take the passage and gently repeat it to yourself. Allow it to interact with both your conscious and unconscious mind. You allow whatever thoughts, feelings, and emotions that come into consciousness to arise and pass away unhindered. So it's not like you're thinking about it. You're just allowing, you're resting with the text. Again, so the thinking mind is still asked to step aside. Thoughts arise, you just notice them as they arise. You need to allow the deepest aspects of yourself to be touched and changed by the phrase you have taken into your heart. So it's more of a transformation than a thinking about. Well, it is that, not a thinking about. The fourth step, well, knowing that you are one with the loving presence of God in the case of Saint Benedict, or you could say the Absolute, is waiting for an understanding of the deeper meaning of the passage to emerge. So while you know this, you're waiting for this a deeper meaning to emerge. That's the fourth. And the fifth and final step is to simply rest in the presence of being and accept the transformation in consciousness that takes place. So it's just resting with the passage and seeing what arises. It's the way we rest with our experience and see what arises and notice what arises at that subtle level, perhaps superficial level, and at the deeper levels. So that's I just thought I'd say something about that kind of, because that often comes up when we talk about this topic. People say, "Well, what about contemplation? Isn't that, you know, a form of thinking?" And it, as I've seen it practiced in the spiritual traditions I'm familiar with, it's not. The only place I've seen thinking mind is in Tibetan Buddhism when they debate. But in a way, if you've ever watched that, they're debating at such a level where they're almost in a trance. I mean, it's a whole other, and it's not a practice I'm familiar with. Either. So you could call that deductive investigation, applying ideas to experience, which is part of the Tibetan practice. They distinguish between deductive investigation and inductive investigation, which is drawing conclusions from direct experience. But by far, the common practice within all the different Buddhist traditions is inductive investigation, and in the other spiritual traditions as well. The Vaidyavedanta in the Hindu tradition has a little bit of the deductive investigation. So it's this direct. So by and large, it's this direct examination of moment to moment. Dogen, or in the tantric path, might have the true nature of mind is pointed out by a guru who you have total faith in. So that's another way of truth arising, is that your guru is somebody who you have total trust and developed over years, and a student-teacher relationship, and their words can trigger insights because they're pointed out by the guru. So that's another. So there are other. I guess I'm saying there are other approaches out there, but by and large, the one I'm talking about is the most common. So what do we investigate? You could investigate right now. You could investigate. So first we notice what's arising in this moment. Notice what our relationship to it is. If it's calm, then you're noticing calm. If there's agitation, you're noticing agitation. What's that feel like? What's the experience of it? What makes it known as agitation? Or whatever it might be. What is it that makes it known as that? So you're bringing some investigation to the topic. Is there suffering present? What's the relationship to that? Is there non-suffering present? What is my relationship to that? Is there thinking about what I just said arising? What is my relationship to that? Is there grasping at trying to understand what I'm saying arising? What is my relationship to that? So it's looking at our relationship to what's arising. We often say, in this practice, it's not about changing your experience. Practice is about changing your relationship to what's arising moment to moment, or your experience. So we investigate our direct experience. How suffering is caused, how non-suffering arises. And that's key. So when I said those on purpose, is there suffering arising? Because we can start to bring investigation to the arising of suffering because we don't want it. Right? Notice that if you do that, do you bring as much investigation to the presence of non-suffering? Because that can be just as illuminating as the other. When this happens, non-suffering arises. So a lot of freedom in that. Also, that also shows us when that doesn't arise, suffering can arise when other experiences arise. Grasping, for example. The other thing we investigate is anicca, anatta, and dukkha, or impermanence. Suffering, as I just talked about it, the arising of suffering or dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, or not self, the selfless nature of what's arising. So that's another aspect of what we can investigate. So here's some questions the investigative mind might ask. What is this experience? What is the Vedna? The pleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? What's the feeling tone of it, or Vedna? What's arising in relation to this? Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Every experience you have has the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral arising. what does this feel like in the body at a gross and subtle level? Is there a hindrance present? And what does it feel like? Is there restlessness? Is there sleepiness? Is there sense desire? Is there aversion? Is there doubt? Not the whole thing. Arising. And what does that feel like? Is it a wholesome state? And what does that feel like? And as you observe it, what happens to it? To the wholesome state or the unwholesome state? As you observe it, what happens to it? What is the attitude of the mind towards the experience? Noticing the attitude of the mind. Some teachers talk about this being a really key part of investigation, is noticing the attitude of the mind in the moment towards the experience. As the experience is known, does it change? Is it stronger, weaker? Does it completely pass away as you bring as it is known? So these are the kinds of questions you can bring. How does it feel? What's your relationship to it? What are the attitudes arising in relationship to it? These are the kinds of questions that are part of investigation. So we may see impermanence, that everything's constantly changing. That's some of the investigation, is, you know, what happens? What happens to it? So I noticed, you know, if there's spilling the beans, is there a metaphor in there? I don't know. After spilling the beans, that there was a contraction in my chest, and I noticed that as that was known, it dissipated, and then a smile and a sense of joy. So that's what was known in that moment. So maybe another time, a similar thing happens. And there's more of a reaction. So then what is known is that. And then the mind kind of goes, ah, so this is suffering. And this is non-suffering. And so new habits start to then develop. Ah, suffering is optional. It's not required here. Suffering is entirely optional. The story and the proliferation and is completely optional. So that's that investigation. Oh, so the joy comes from seeing that it's entirely optional. So nothing is the same for even two consecutive moments. Everything is different. Is becoming other than it is now in this moment. So even when we say, you know, the arising and passing away, even during the arising, every moment it's shifting, and all those moments of it passing away, it's shifting. If you can start to see impermanence at that level, the subtler level, you really see impermanence. And I've said this before here, the Buddha doesn't ask for blind faith on any of this. So we see the truth for ourselves. And you see it in your experience, what arises for you, what investigating the nature of your experience in relation to the world and what's arising in your life. Truth isn't found through surface knowledge. It's this deeper knowledge. So here's another example of investigation to work with the dependent origination process, which is really the process is the wheel of some of suffering. Of samsara. We can bring our investigation to components of that process. Again, another way to see deeply. So here's some sequence of events, and how the sense of self is rarefied in our minds. So first thing you might notice is in my life I've experienced all the suffering that the Buddha described. Pain, sorrow, lamentation, despair, grief, separation from my loved ones, losses, illness, and not always getting what I wanted. So you start to see, I've experienced all of those. So you kind of, that's first noble truth. there's a lot of freedom just in seeing that. That part of being human is having these experiences. It's not meant to depress you. it's seeing the truth of our of human existence. That we'll all when of these happens, it's not like, oh, that's a surprise. I didn't know I'd get ill. That's a surprise. I didn't think I'd ever lose a loved one. That's a surprise. I thought I'd always get what I wanted. Just in that, investigating and seeing that at a deep level is very, very freeing. So the second one, every moment of suffering has come from craving, from wanting things to be other than they are. So notice what happens when you want things to be other than they are in that moment. And notice what arises when you're okay with what arises in that moment. So out noticing suffering and non-suffering. If you get that far, you're like, so, I mean, it's that number two, it's so transformative, just being with in relationship to the world in that way. This craving, wanting things to be different, that I experience is always related to feelings. What I want to have is pleasant feelings all the time. And this is what motivates many of my behaviors. We want to pile up pleasant vedna, pleasant feeling tone. And if I can just organize things just so, I'll be happy. I can get this, the right relationship in the right house with the right this, and then I'll be happy. But it's seeing through that, seeing that craving is always based on wanting a pleasant feelings. Investigating the arising of feelings, the confluence of the six sense objects, sense organs, and the six sense consciousness, which I've talked about before. So it's investigating that feelings arise as a result of that. So just you're seeing your experience as its bare essentials. Everything you experience is a sense organ, so ear being a sense organ, a sound, and consciousness of it. So some people may not be conscious of the sound of the motorcycle, but it sounds happening, but it's not part of your experience if you didn't have a, it didn't come into consciousness. So that's your experience, is those three things coming together. So it's investigating and knowing that. And you can just watch it moment by moment. Oh, there it is. Oh, what if I expand my consciousness to include faraway sounds? Oh, man. It's a whole other world. You know, but that, so that becomes your experience. So you can just noticing and investigating this. Through consistent and penetrating investigation of the sense organs, the sense objects, and sense consciousness, I can see that there is no self to be found as part of, behind, or in control of my life. So this is getting a little deeper now. So there's nobody controlling what's arising. Like, you're not controlling what's arising in terms of the sense consciousness, sense organs. So that's getting into an investigation around not self. You can do this any time of the day. See, notice if you're in control of what thought's going to arise next. That's a fun investigation. Or notice if you're in control of what intention is going to arise next. Intention which motivates our behaviors. So just go for a walk and don't pick a destination and notice when intentions arise to turn this way or that way, to stop. Notice if you're in control of those. Or are they just arising based on causes and conditions that are not in your control? Here's a quote from Wu Wei Wu, who's it says, we do not possess an ego. We are possessed by the idea of one. So we're possessed by this idea of a separate, independent self. The other thing we can discern or investigate is what's called this-that conditionality. It's again getting a little... And here's a quote from the Buddha. And what is the noble method that is rightly seen by discernment? So he's speaking precisely about investigation, what to investigate. What is this noble method? There's the case where a noble one notices when this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. I'll read that again. It's a that's the kind of the level of noticing. When this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. So that's what you investigate. In fact, I could just say that and leave the room. I mean, the Buddha said, here's what the wise one discerns. So you're seeing this arises, suffering arises. If this, when this ceases, so, you know, so it's not just suffering, it's everything. This, it's seeing the conditionality. He calls it, it's been called the this-that conditionality. So as I said at the beginning, and I'll conclude with this bit, investigation leads to liberating insight when it's combined with mindfulness. So it's bhavanamaya panya, wisdom born of meditation. So sometimes meditation is that one-pointed, you know, attention following the breath, just observing the rise and fall. And other times it's more directed towards insight, and we did a choiceless awareness, which kind of then opens your field of awareness to whatever's arising. It's not pointed at an object, but it's spacious and open, just noticing. And this is where you can bring in investigation. It's time to do a Dharma investigation. If the mind's really active, great time to do investigate. Don't think you have to have a calm, completely calm mind. You notice when the mind's busy, it's always involved in ignorance. It's always clinging, full of clinging and aversion, which is bound to lead to suffering. And maybe you notice the arising of suffering. So, I mean, don't look at that as, you know, I can't do investigation. You can do all kinds of investigation around what's arising in the mind, around grasping and aversion. When the mind is busy thinking, it's always involved in ignorance. It's always grasping, pushing away. So the more we do this investigation, the more the word that came to mind is fit and pliable. The mind becomes having an ability to absorb or assimilate new understandings or new insights. So it's like a snowball effect. So investigation may seem, difficult or disjointed or at first, but as it kind of gets rolling, your mind becomes more open to these insights, to these understandings. So the Buddha talked about the four factors that are conducive to the growth in wisdom, to acquiring insight, to the growth of insight, and the increase in insight. So the four factors that contribute to the growth in wisdom, to acquiring insight, to the growth of insight, and to the increase of insight. And the four elements are, drum roll, you've probably heard these before, association with spiritual friends. So part of what we do here is associate with others who are interested in this, hearing the teachings, the other is investigation of the mind, thorough systematic attention to what's arising in the mind is the third one. And the fourth is behavior in accordance with the teachings, to behave in accordance with the Dharma. So when I saw that, when I first saw that, they make sense, right? But then that third one's like, wow, that's prominent. She didn't say, like, be mindful. It's like, investigate. So that it has a prominent place in the teachings. Yeah, I'll end there to leave a bit of time for any questions or observations or on that talk or anything else that's come up.
Especially for me, it's
Mind, and we live in a world of language and words. So I gave you offered questions, not so much as, I mean, you can use them as questions to ask about your experience. If you're new to investigation, you may want to actually allow those questions to emerge and to kind of get into the flow of what it feels like to do investigation. So you could actually use those questions as you get more familiar with what investigation is. You don't need the questions, you don't need the words. You can just rest in open observation and discernment of what's arising. It's nonverbal. So that as you become more familiar with the process and the method of investigation. Well, I think the questions help at first. If this is something newer to us, the questions can be quite helpful to just get the flow of it. The other thing is, the mind wants to jump in. So even if in that process of opening and allowing, an understanding, some transformation may emerge. You may notice the mind wanting to apply words to it. That's okay. It's, just noticing. That's what the mind does. So we can get sucked into that. Oh wow! This must be an insight. And oh no, I got to do this to it. I better write it down so I don't forget it. And I got to tell my wife and kids, and I got to put it on a poster, and laminate it, get attached to insights as well. So yeah, it's noted, but I'm weaving quite a tale there. But just noticing when the mind gets engaged.
Hi. When you talked today about suffering, I can't get out of my mind what's happening to people in the fall. There has to be years of suffering. When people struggle without falling, most of my life has been in caring for family. That they must be going through in trying to be there for each other. I've had the opportunity to both. Kathmandu and the monastery have been missing for people for years about mindfulness, calling, all the things you've talked about tonight. And I'm caught in how they're coping. How is that traditional spirituality serving the Native?
Yeah. I imagine there, the situation in Nepal is there's a lot of suffering that's going on, and I imagine And your question, how are they? You know, that so much of the Dharma came from that, from Nepal and other neighboring countries. How are they relating to it? I think with compassion, from what the few places I know. So compassion is arising for the people that are suffering. And compassion then is transforming into action to help those where they can. On the ground, with food, finding food, water, you know, like we do in any natural disaster. There's certain things that you just happen. They just go through as compassion arises. I mean, we can help. I mean, they need funds. The monasteries need funds. We were just talking about this before. Before we started tonight, so this sitting group donated money to the Namo Buddha Foundation. So if you Google Namo, N-A-M-O, Buddha Foundation, you'll find it's a Canadian, has a Canadian tax charity number and everything. And the money goes directly to the Rinpoche and the monastery in Nepal. From what I understand, they're providing just basic, using the money to buy basic nice thing. Monks don't, you know, there's no overhead here. There's no salaried people, right? There's no people sitting on laptops writing proposals to international development. You know, I've been in that business, and I call it a business for over 10 years and off and on, and so I really enjoy the organizations that are grassroots, connected to the community, and just, you know, going out and doing what they can. So supporting the monasteries is a good way to do that. And here's an easy one. You can go online and click donate, and you get your tax receipt. So if people are open to it, we could give some more as a sitting group. We have a lot of the money we have goes to the church to help keep for the space. But lately we've had some surplus. And if anybody would like to, you can just do it yourself at Namo Buddha Foundation. And there's others, I'm sure. That's just one that I'm familiar with. So there's. And with short of going there and doing what we can, this is the way that we can provide some financial support. So thank you everyone for coming. Okay. You have a question? Okay.
You have to be really very sensitive to
Thank you. Again, thank you, everyone.